From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield. A few days ago, an email came in from a friend in Slovenia, forwarded from a friend of his in Germany, originating in how many pass-alongs there's no telling, from a hospital in Indonesia. It was a photograph of a 2-year-old boy separated from his parents in the tsunami. A week earlier, a Swedish child had been reunited with his father following another global email search, one of several ways the internet figured into the tsunami aftermath more than in any previous natural disaster. Online billboards were established to exchange information about missing loved ones. Millions of dollars were raised for relief efforts using online payment services. Bloggers transmitted up to the second news and video with unprecedented speed. According to Esther Dyson, editor of Release 1.0 at CNET Networks and noted internet guru, it all marked the convergence of the digital revolution with a tragic twist of fortune.
I think the first thing was how lucky they were that there were all these foreign tourists there. You had the poor people living in the flatlands on the beach and the rich people living in the hotels on the beach. And that created a huge tragedy, but also a uniquely favorable condition for the internet getting involved. It just caught the internet's eye. Unfortunately, there were no foreign tourists in Rwanda. There weren't as many foreign tourists in Bosnia.
What we saw in fundraising, in news reporting, in the application of search technology and so forth, were these refinements over how the internet has been used in the past, or were there some sort of giant leaps forward?
I would say everything we saw was stuff that was already happening on a small scale. What's great about the internet is how well it scales up. Usually when things scale up, the individual loses power, but this gives the powers that institutions used to have to broadcast, to find things, to do research, to get heard. It gives those out to individuals across the entire internet. And when something huge like this happens, that just becomes much more apparent.
In Wednesday's New York Times, you expressed a lot of enthusiasm about the use of the net for what amounts to, I guess, a digital human lost and found.
It's actually better than a lost and found, because in a lost and found, you have to go to the right place and point to the item. What's so miraculous about this is it's a Google search. From anywhere in the world, you can go directly to anywhere else in the world that the right information is posted.
Let's for a moment talk about the money-raising aspect of all of this. It struck me as being similar to Howard Dean's fundraising efforts in his presidential campaign. Was the mechanism approximately the same?
The mechanism was very much the same in the sense that it was reaching out to people who wanted to get involved. The precise mechanisms were different, but it reached a huge audience. Friends would pass links along to their friends. And in both cases, people were just astonished at how much money was ready to be sent out once people's imaginations or hearts were tugged at.
Is it fair to say that this kind of disaster relief could never have flowed in from ordinary individuals so quickly absent the internet? I mean, obviously, there's some logistics attached to collecting coin containers at the checkout lanes at Walmart.
The real difference is not even in how fast you could collect the money, but how fast you could set up mechanisms to reach people. The day of the disaster, you could decide you wanted to collect money and pass it to your favorite charity. You could post missing people, and using Google and other search tools, people could find you. So the speed at which things can happen, the responsiveness is hugely different from what was available before. And people now, they're used to getting on the internet and doing things instead of waiting passively for an institution to do it for them. So in some sense, what this really indicates is the decentralization of charity as well as everything else.
You were talking about the convergence of circumstances that brought the world's attention and action on this catastrophe, while the world has mainly sat on its hands about genocide in Africa and the AIDS epidemic, which is destroying the very infrastructure of an entire continent. Do you believe that what we learned as empowered internet users in South Asia could affect the world's apparent indifference to places that are far away and not top of mind?
I think it's an incremental step. Number one, getting people to pay attention, for example, to poor people in Thailand. But second, getting them to realize that, yes, they can be involved. It's not that remote. They can go online and find out not just the best book on Amazon, but the They can find out about some village in Thailand that all it needs is 3 cell phones and an electrical generator, and it could change 200 villagers' lives.
Before I let you go, I just want to ask you what the internet could have done that it actually failed to do. In USA Today on Wednesday, Kevin Maney's column pointed out the failure of the net, or at least the lack of certain infrastructures that could have actually alerted the affected coastlines hours before the tsunami even hit.
Well, that's the real tragedy, that there was no warning. And you didn't need the internet. Just radio would have done it fine. There were some seismologists who were beginning to get a sense of what was going on, but they couldn't reach anybody. And that wasn't a failure of the internet. That was a failure of governments, a failure of officials. And I think a lot of the problems you're seeing now are, again, failures of the local political and administrative infrastructure to get help where it's needed, to organize relief efforts. And my hope is that a lot of the relief efforts that come in are going to leave things behind, not just physical things, but attitudes and just understandings of what communication can do, and sort of an assumption that, gee, we should be online with the rest of the world.
Esther, thanks so very much.
Thank you very much.
Esther Dyson is editor of Release 1.0 at CNET Networks.
This tsunami footage came courtesy not of CNN, ABC, or Fox. It's part of a vlog, or video log, collected by an ordinary citizen and disseminated via the internet. Blogger Jeff Jarvis says it's evidence that the revolution is no longer on our doorstep, it's in our computers, and all power to the people.
I think we'll find that this is the real growth of citizens' video online, vlogging as it's also called. It's really going to come of age now because you have all the elements in place to allow any witness to news to be able to capture and distribute that news to the world. One, you have cheap and good equipment. Number two, you have good tools for Macintoshes and other software. Number three, you have the means to distribute it online. And number four, you can find the stuff through blogs and Google and so on. I saw the videos of the tsunami hours before I saw them on TV online because bloggers pointed to them. So witnesses become reporters the world around.
Tell me from both the supply side and the demand side why this changes everything.
Because it explodes television. It used to be if you wanted to make TV, you either had to have expensive equipment or you had to make nice with Ted Turner. Now you don't have to. Now, for very little money, you can make credible, important, compelling television, as the tsunami's proved, and you can put it online and be found. It also goes back to Jon Stewart's appearance on Crossfire when he had all that fun.
You're doing theater when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
You do no, it's
not
true.
Honest. What you do is not
element,
honest.
Course,
what you do is partisan hackery.
That was watched by maybe a couple hundred thousand people on CNN, big old CNN. And then it was over. If you missed it, it was gone. But then people copied that and put that online through a BitTorrent, which is a way to distribute video, or iFilm, and now millions of people have seen that same video. So the distribution network, the citizens' distribution network of online, is more powerful than the big old networks. And that really changes everything.
So that would be the demand side, people actually wanting to look at it. It's one thing for someone who fancies himself an undiscovered TV personality to put up a blog with video, and another thing for people actually to watch it. And certainly during natural disasters when hours and minutes are of the essence, the public showed that it will in fact go not to CNN or Fox or MSNBC, but to the internet.
Or that Fox and CNN and MSNBC will come to the internet to find this stuff. And that's important to the news business too, because it's a new supply of news and information and diverse viewpoints and eyewitnesses that we in the news business couldn't afford before. Now there are great new sources of news, and we've got to look at it that way.
All right, so we've been sitting here for the last few years waiting for the model that underpins network television, just waiting for it to implode before our eyes. What does this mean for the future of, let's start with network news operations?
Network news operations are going to have to operate on a smaller and smaller and smaller budget. So that's just the future of the business. And cable, too. People are going to be able to watch whatever they want to watch whenever they want to watch it. Except for sports, live is dead. You don't wait for the news to come to you. Now we go to the news. Now we'll go and find that tsunami video or that Jon Stewart segment or that weather report or that sports segment by any means we want to. Online, eventually through our phone, eventually through high bandwidth, everywhere. That changes the essential relationship of people to media.
All right, let me get to the old bugaboo about the internet, and that is the question of filters. You know, it's certainly clear that the public at large does not trust the media filter as it is. The professionals determine what constitutes news and what doesn't, what's fair, what's ethical, and so on. But by what process will people be able to credit one vlog, one video log news source from another?
The wisdom of the crowds, to quote James Horowicki's book title, really does matter. Blogs have proven to be a self-correcting mechanism. People swarm on me when I make a mistake at BuzzMachine.com, like white blood cells on germs, and they swarm on Dan Rather when he makes a mistake. There's a self-correcting mechanism and a quality mechanism. The quality rises. The people who get links have more authority. And that was true during the tsunami with video, too. The good stuff rose.
So then the democratization of content that was so long promised to us and not necessarily delivered by the internet is actually beginning to materialize before our eyes.
It absolutely is. We really have a chance now for people to be witnesses to news, to report news, to give us viewpoints more than we ever had before, and for the citizens to in turn edit that and say what's good and what's credible and what's not. It truly is about using the tools of media to enable the citizens to speak.
All right, now let me ask you one personal question, and I apologize in advance, but a couple of years ago, you yourself experimented with video blogging, and at some expense of money, time, and of course, prestige, because it didn't really work. Tell me what has changed, and are you delighted that it has finally come to pass, or are you just so mad that you were 2 years ahead of the curve?
No, I learned. I used a new tool 2 years ago that allowed you to put a teleprompter in your laptop and have a green screen behind you and act like you're at the White House, and it was a cool tool to play with, but the other legs of the stool weren't yet in place to distribute this. They are now. And I think that it's fun to be there a little bit early. And no, I think I'm going to go buy a Macintosh this week and start to play with it anew and have my 12-year-old teach me how to do TV.
Okay. Well, good luck. And thanks very much once again for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeff Jarvis, former editor of Entertainment Weekly, blogs at BuzzMachine.com. By the way, new CNN president Jonathan Klein agrees with Jon Stewart. Klein canceled Crossfire. Coming up, a storm is brewing at the Weather Channel and why you are listening to History Being Made right this second, or maybe later. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. We've just heard about one way internet technology is pushing the envelope of everything we thought we knew about TV broadcasting. But thanks to the ever-expanding capacity of internet servers and hard drives, radio, too, is at a crossroads. Radio broadcasts, of course, happen at a given time, and receivers are either tuned in or not. Even satellite radio, which conquers the limitations of the radio signal, is fixed in time. But what if a radio program could be harvested and stored for internet distribution and play later at the convenience of the user? Then you would have what's called podcasting, a technology that has come from nowhere over the past few months. This program, in fact, marks the first NPR show to be distributed that way as well as over the air. Joining me now to discuss podcasting is Todd Maffin, the technology columnist for CBC Radio. Todd, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Okay, please break it down for us. What is podcasting and where did it come from?
Well, quite frankly, all a podcast is attaching an audio file to a blog posting. How it's different in an incredible way is that you can subscribe to one of these feeds, essentially, and as soon as there's new content, it automatically transfers that radio show directly into your MP3 player or iPod, which is where it gets the name podcasting. So in other words, in the morning, you know, over the course of the night, it's downloaded all of these radio shows that you tune into, and you just pick up your iPod or MP3 player of choice and go jogging or take it on the commute in.
So it sounds like essentially a TiVo for the radio. There would be no excuse for anyone to miss any future broadcast of On the Media because it's just sitting there waiting for you.
Well, that's right. And I mean, this is one of the areas that I find so exciting about the technology. Radio programmers for decades have been trying to convince the listening audience to go into a phase that is referred to in the industry as appointment listening. I want them to all tune into my show at X time. Well, that's not the way we use radio. The way the listeners use radio is you're driving, or you're doing the dishes, or you're doing housework, or something like that. It's on in the background. Now we're just letting the listeners choose the time that's best for them.
You've been following this for some months now, and you must have heard some remarkable programming from hitherto unexpected sources, and you must have heard an awful lot of dreck. What's out there?
A lot of dreck. There really is. But I mean, I think in many cases, there's a lot of really solid content. One of my favorite podcasts is produced here in Canada called Coverville.com, which is a guy that just likes cover music and tribute bands, and he plays, you know, 45-minute shows. One of the most popular podcasts right now is called The Don and Drew Show, which is produced by a married couple who just sort of chat for about 45 minutes before they go to bed.
The laundry's done.
Yeah.
Drew and I have seemed to have gone on some kind of laundry strike.
Sabbatical.
Yes, sabbatical.
You know, Bob, I can't tell you what it is about that show. They talk about nothing, but it is the most compelling listening somehow because it's unique. You feel like you're getting into someone's head, and you don't get that very much from radio.
I want to talk to you about the famous internet promise, democratization. Now, obviously, this broadcast, which is now a podcast, is brought to you by WNYC and NPR, two enormous institutions. But just as blogs brought poorly capitalized and obscure people to the forefront, don't you expect that just regular Joes who have something to say can now podcast their way into the national or even global consciousness?
Yeah, and I think that's great. I mean, I think it is very much revolutionary. You know, you're seeing how these podcasters are teaching themselves the tools of the radio trade. It's sort of like Radio Boot Camp 101 on their own dime. It's very easy for a radio network to pick up on that. One great example is TreasureIslandOldies.com, which started out many years ago as one of the first streaming internet radio shows, developed a loyal following, and was suddenly picked up by radio stations around the world. You know, you're listening to these amateur radio producers learning the craft on air, as it were. So you hear people, you know, make mistakes and revoice something or feed the dog in the middle of their podcast. And ironically, in that way, this medium is a lot more like the old-fashioned style of radio, where things were live. There was a sort of a more heightened sense of surprise in it. And I think that's only good for radio.
Now, one of the advantages of radio historically has been that it is live. Its immediacy is very important to the whole radio experience. And then, of course, there's the issue of news, weather, sports, and traffic, which drive a whole lot of radio listening. Does podcasting have built-in limitations because it is not operating in the here and now?
Absolutely. This is a store and retrieve model. But you might see it sort of evolve the way that television has, which is for those people who can afford the devices like TiVo or Replay TV, those PVRs, they're sort of the rich cousins of the television world. There'll always be live television for special events like sports broadcasts and news broadcasts. I think similarly with podcasting, there'll always be the need for live radio, for live breaking news. I mean, radio does that more effectively than any medium just because we don't need to set up cameras or lights. We just go on the air with a cell phone. I think this is just a different medium, a different way of extending that kind of content.
All right, this show is being broadcast in January of 2005. When can WNYC just blow up its broadcast towers? When can we stop transmitting over the air?
I would guess the FCC probably wouldn't let you do that, but I don't think you'd want to do that either. I think there's going to be a need for both. One of the big misnomers about technology is that it replaces things. You know, video didn't kill the radio star. I don't think podcasters will kill the radio star. I think they'll just change the radio star.
Okay, Todd, finally, you are participating in the first podcast in the history of National Public Radio. Do you want to say hi, Mom?
Hi, Mom.
All right. Todd Maffin is the technology columnist for CBC Radio. He spoke to us from Vancouver. You can read his thoughts on technology and media at iloveradio.org. In the early 1980s, a Kansas City news anchor named Christine Kraft won a $500,000 judgment after being demoted because of her age and her looks. The case gained national attention and sparked a conversation about sex and age discrimination in broadcasting. Well, a lot has changed since then. News presentation, competition, fashion standards, even the standards of projecting sexuality have evolved or devolved in 20 years. So it's probably time to have that conversation again. This time in the role of the aggrieved party, former Weather Channel anchor Marnie Stanier. She lost her job a little over a year ago after a long career both in front of the camera and behind the scenes. And she's recently filed an age and sex discrimination lawsuit in federal district court in Atlanta. What makes this case unique is that we can all go straight to the videotape. Stanier has a video of the network's programming chief, Terry Conley, issuing directives about sexiness and dowdiness to the women of the Weather Channel. We'll hear some of that in a moment. First, Daniel Klein is the lawyer representing Marnie Stanier, and he joins me now from Atlanta. Dan, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
Lay out the particulars of the case for me, please. It's clear cut to you, I assume, that this was a case of age and sex discrimination and not something else that caused her to lose her job.
Marnie Stanier was tossed aside because the Weather Channel wanted a younger, sexier look for its female weathercasters. Marnie was one of the top performing OCMs, that's Weather Channel talk for on-camera meteorologists, at the Weather Channel for more than 16 years. She had received excellent evaluations throughout her career and had worked her way up to an OCM manager. And in that capacity, she both appeared on camera and supervised other weathercasters. In around 2003, the Weather Channel became obsessed with the idea that its look was too old. The senior vice president of programming and production, Terry Conley, made no secret of the fact that he wanted to, in his words, young up the Weather Channel. And he went around telling people, making no secret of it, that the look of the Weather Channel, and particularly the women who were appearing as on-camera weathercasters, was, in his words, matronly and dowdy and needed to be younged up.
Well, lucky for Marnie Stanier, she actually came in possession of video taken of some in-house training sessions conducted by Terry Conley. And one of the clips sounds like this.
Dowdy, look at, and this is, she's a young woman. I would bet she's early 30s and she looks late 40s. That's what clothes can do to you. Do you want to look old?
These video clips are the equivalent of the Rodney King videotape. They're smoking gun evidence that what the Weather Channel wanted to do was young up the look of its female on-camera meteorologists.
What you can't see is she is wearing a short black skirt with a slit up the side, gang. Okay?
Wow.
And now you're not going to see it. They ain't bland. They ain't dowdy. They ain't matronly.
I must say, this is a tough one for me because, of course, I believe that as a matter of human behavior and social policy and law, everybody should be protected from age and sex discrimination, and nobody's job should be hanging in the balance of something so superficial as looks. And yet, the reality is this is show business. I mean, yes, it's meteorology, but it's also show business. And their advertising revenue is directly associated with their ratings. And their ratings, they can show to a fare-thee-well, although they won't present it in court because it's self-indicting, but they could prove to a fare-thee-well are related to the looks of the people on camera. What is the broadcast news industry supposed to do about the collision of these two realities?
The broadcast industry is expected to do what society is expected to do as a whole, which is to shed stereotypes. Just a few decades ago, there were jobs that were considered inappropriate for women because of outdated stereotypes. Go back a few more years and you exclude group after group from positions of responsibility in our society. The market will shed those stereotypes, and to a large degree, it already has. I don't think anyone's going to tell you today that viewers would not accept weathercasters like Marnie Stanier. In fact, her ratings suggested that she had no problems with the viewers. It was the stereotyped view of the Weather Channel that caused the problems here.
Well, Dan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dan Klein with Buckley & Klein in Atlanta is representing Marnie Stanier in her lawsuit against the Weather Channel. The Weather Channel declined to comment on this story.
In more than one way, it isn't easy being an old gray lady of journalism. The New York Times has certainly found itself abused quite a bit lately. The latest broadside comes in a book titled The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. The premise of authors Howard Friel and Richard Falk is that the paper of record irresponsibly stood mute as a series of U.S. administrations flouted international law in pursuit of their global objectives. Readers of the paper, they argue, would be hard-pressed to find any mention of the many UN resolutions, world court rulings, or global treaties that run contrary to those objectives. Co-author Richard Falk says the examples of New York Times negligence comprise a history, an insufficiently critical history, of U.S. impunity.
The whole coverage of the Vietnam War, the coverage of the Iraq debate prior to the war, the way in which the Nicaragua judgment of the World Court was treated, the recent decision by the World Court on the security wall between Israel and Palestine. But when international law was on the side of the U.S., for instance, during the hostage crisis in Iran, when there was a World Court decision supporting the U.S. view that holding the hostages was a violation of international law, the New York Times accentuated that. The Times is very happy with international law when it supports American foreign policy. It only avoids its implications when it's critical of foreign policy.
But in fairness to the Times, they have over the years editorialized about the U.S. relationship with the U.N. and about international courts of justice and Kyoto and so forth. Overall, over the decades, suggesting that the United States should pay more attention to global warming, not less, should be more in tune with the United Nations, not less. Aren't in many ways the components of your premise about the responsibilities of New York Times found every day within its editorial and news pages?
I wish they were. And it's precisely because they have a liberal outlook that is generally supportive of international cooperation that one would have expected them to treat international law in these critical foreign policy debates in a more even-handed way. Their record is less than what one would hope for.
Do you believe that this is because they are intentionally biased in support of the administration in power, no matter what it would be? Or is there some other explanation for what you call its reflexive support of administration policy, no matter how unilateral it may be?
I think the main thing is that the Times is preoccupied with maintaining its credibility. And its credibility depends with not seeming to be too far removed from government foreign policy, particularly in war-peace issues. Until that policy goes bad, after the Vietnam War began to fail, and now that the Iraq policies are failing, you will find lots of criticism of the policies, because then their credibility depends on showing a certain sense of objectivity.
I think it's dangerous and probably fatuous to think of the American media as some monolith, you know, driven by the same interests and biases and so forth. Is it possible that it's also mistaken to view the New York Times as a monolith or even an institution that is driven in everything it does by some central principle? Is there not the chance that in your book you are attributing to the New York Times a kind of institutional will that really doesn't exist on the ground day to day?
We do feel that there is a consistent New York Times philosophy that governs the limits of what journalists and contributors are able to say. And there are examples of journalists that transcended those limits and were, in effect, punished or transferred to less high-profile roles. And we give some examples in the book. But you also need to remember that there's a sophistication about this philosophy. It doesn't want to seem too rigid, because then it would interfere with one important goal of the New York Times, which is to convey to readers that, in fact, it is objective and impartial.
Newspapers have often been called the first rough draft of history. Essentially, their job is to record what happened and then report and sometimes analyze it for the readership. If the United States government, especially since the end of World War II, has behaved in a certain way with respect to international institutions like the United Nations and the World Health Organization, can we expect the New York Times to do anything but reflect the way the government is behaving?
Yes, I think we can expect a responsible newspaper that claims to be the newspaper of record to give the American people or its readers the kind of information that would help them reach an informed judgment. We're not asking that the New York Times become polemical. What we're saying is that by excluding criticism from the perspective of international law, they are excluding one of the most important ways of judging controversial foreign policy decisions.
Well, Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Falk is a visiting professor of global and international studies at University of California, Santa Barbara, and author with Howard Friel of The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports U.S. Foreign Policy. Editors at The New York Times declined our invitation to respond. Coming up, a special look at magazines, including How to Succeed, How to Fail, and How to Win the Heart of a Man Called Mr. Magazine. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at wrjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It's early, of course, but so far this hasn't been a very good millennium for the American magazine industry. Advertising fled during the recession, never completely to return. Circulation has been stagnant or worse, and the editorial integrity of some titles has been called into question as publishers seek to make advertisers happy with content more promotional than journalistic. Watching all of this is Samir Husni, professor of journalism at the University of Mississippi and known far and wide as Mr. Magazine. And he joins me now. Samir, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So what ails the magazine industry?
The major problem is that magazines after September 11 have become the only comfort food that is arriving at mailboxes and the newsstands. So yes, some people may say we've dumped the content a little bit or the line between editorial and advertising has been crossed. But the more the magazines become specialized, the more that line is going to blur. But contrary to your pessimistic announcement, I think the magazine industry last year and so far the forecast for 2005 is going to be in a very good shape compared to what happened in the early part of the 21st century. Once we have all the numbers tallied for 2004, we will probably have more than 1,000 new titles, which is the largest number since 1998.
Of course, people keep opening restaurants in New York, too. They don't necessarily last very long. Obviously, there are a lot of failures, but someone's succeeding. Who is out there who's cracked the nut?
Maxim. When Maxim came to the United States and Felix Dennis tried to launch Maxim, there was not one single expert in this country who said this magazine will work. Maxim has now a circulation of 2.5 million. Real simple. When it first came out in the marketplace, everybody said, this is from Time Inc. Time Inc. will do something like that. And look where Real Simple is now. So the odds are against you from the very beginning. But everybody had that Lisa Newsom dream, the woman that started in 1988 Veranda magazine and sold it 2 years ago to Hearst for almost $50 million. Everybody wants to be that entrepreneur.
A couple of years ago, one of the big new introductions was a magazine called Lucky, which just made my jaw drop because it was a magazine about shopping. Tell me how that's doing And tell me if there's any similar counterintuitive offerings coming up in 2005.
Lucky is doing very, very good. In fact, it's doing so well that after Lucky succeeded, we've seen a slew of shopping magazines, not only in the United States, but all over the world. Everybody that discovered that, hey, we can take all these catalogs that used to be available for free, put them all in a magazine and charge for it and make some money. So Lucky came to the market. Then we had Cargo, the buying magazine for men, since men don't shop, they just buy. I mean, almost every magazine you pick now, there's a new magazine that came out this year called Cats. It's a shopping magazine for your cat.
No, it isn't.
It is. It is an annual, published once a year, everything you ever wanted to buy for your cat in one magazine.
let's talk about the relationship between the editorial side of magazines and advertisers, because the magazine industry in the United States has always been a girl with a reputation. But it seems that lately the pandering has really turned to whoring, and that editorial content is barely distinguishable from the ads. Am I imagining this?
No, you're not. But it depends also on which magazines you are looking at. I mean, you still can pick up a copy of the Atlantic Monthly, and you are not going to find any blurring. You're not going to find something that say, oh, is this an ad or is this an editorial? Because the audience of the Atlantic Monthly is different than the audience of Lucky, is different than the audience of Shop, etc. We have to judge the magazines by the audience that they are intended to. When you pick up a magazine like All You that is only sold at Walmart, you know that the content, it's not dictated by Walmart, but it has to adhere to the Walmart standards because that's the audience that's going to go and pick up that magazine and shop. That's where the blurry line that some people are saying that exists now in our magazines. But the magazines in this country has been specialized from the very beginning. Look at all the automotive magazines that were started in the 40s and the 50s that were dedicated to a very specific car, whether it's a Pontiac, whether it's a Mustang, whether it's a Ford, a Chevy truck. Which ads did you find on those magazines? I mean, you pick up a magazine like Dog Fancy, you expect to see ads for dog food. You don't expect to see ads for McDonald's.
Forgive me for asking the question you must field all the time, but you see, you know, a bazillion magazines every month. What do you actually read for pleasure and not for scholarship?
To me, I mean, anything that says volume one, number one, since I was in eighth grade, is my pleasure reading. And my excuse at the same time, so my wife don't get mad at me if she sees me reading something she does not approve of. It better says in big type, Premier Collector's Edition.
Well, Mr. Magazine, thank you so much for joining us. And of course, our best regards to Mrs. Magazine as well.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Samir Husni is a professor of journalism at the University of Mississippi and widely known as Mr. Magazine. If the prospects for magazine success are daunting, the rewards from a big score are no less attractive than ever. And publishers from Time Inc. to Condé Nast to no one you've ever heard of launch new titles year after year. Among the startups in 2005, Tango, the magazine for relationships, which debuts February 1st. Media consultant and my old friend, Ava Sieve, is general manager of this project, and she joins me now. Ava, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Glad to be here.
Well, Ava, let's see. Magazines had a horrible 2002. They had a horrible 2003. They had a bad 2004. First quarter 2005 looking not so great, and you're starting a magazine. First question, what the hell is the matter with you?
I'm an optimist, and if there's an illness with being an optimist, I suppose that's what I've got. But also, when you say magazines have had a horrible period, you're looking at the entire category of magazines. And that is an inappropriate analysis of what magazines are. Magazines have individual niches, which are quite small. And depending on who they're selling to, how they're selling, and what their cost structure is, they may or may not be very successful. And you have to really look at individual categories as well as individual titles.
Let's talk about Tango and what it's all about. It is a relationships magazine, but women's service magazines also are heavily about relationships and constant talk about the male-female dynamic. How is Tango different?
Tango magazine, the magazine about relationships, is different from other women's lifestyle publications. We're not really a service magazine. Tango looks at everything that a regular women's publication would look at through the filter of relationships. Because, as we like to say in our office, what sex is to men, relationships are to women. we just think about them all the time. Married women, women who are dating, women who are living with guys. We see relationship as a filter of a lot of stuff. So, for example, when we did a piece on hair conditioners, we actually gave the hair conditioners to four couples, and we asked them to try it, both men and women, and they wrote about that. It was interesting, and it was different from the usual product, stand-up product shot, and so forth.
Tango is a very clever name, because after all, it takes two to... Yeah. But another name for the magazine, had you asked me, might have been Men's Ultimate Nightmare Magazine, because if there's one thing that men don't want to do is discuss relationships in any way, shape, or form. Is there any male audience anywhere in your business plan?
Yes, we think that people who are in a current relationship sometimes will find an article interesting enough. They'll show the man they're living with or their husband because it's going to be easier to have the fellow read it than to have that conversation. So actually, it may help men who really hate to talk about stuff because they can read it.
For some years now, at magazine meetings, the leaders of the industry have been wringing their hands and beating their breasts about the model being broken. Tell me, please, what the model is and what about it isn't working right.
A typical consumer magazine gets money from two different ways: for the subscription, the actual copy sold, and also gets money from advertisers. So even if you only pay 50 cents a copy for a magazine, an advertiser will pay the magazine company $7, $8, $20 for each individual copy to be in the hands of the readers. When advertising revenue started dropping away, suddenly the magazine companies found that they had very little money coming in from subscriptions and for newsstand, and very little money coming in for advertising. And so some publications really found out that their cost structure was not working for them. Tango's cost structure is very low by design. One big thing is direct mail costs a lot of money. As a consequence, we aren't doing any. And we are very creative about how we get our circulation.
If you're not going to do direct mail to get your subscribers, what is your secret new plan for low-cost circulation promotion?
It's not a secret. One of the success stories which did alternative circulation without direct mail is a publication called Budget Living, which has gotten a lot of good press. And the web has become an incredibly successful way for smaller publications to launch their circulation subscriptions. We're using that to the fullest. We have a relationship with a website called Perfect Match, which has millions of people who actually pay money to get fixed up online. And we really deliver the kind of content and make people feel good about relationships and so forth. And so we have a relationship with them, so to speak.
Just curious, do you find yourself calling the website to talk about your relationship?
No, not generally.
Thank you, Ava.
You're welcome.
Magazine consultant Ava Sieve is a partner in Quantum Media and also the general manager of the soon-to-be-unveiled Tango magazine. If Tango succeeds finding a niche, that doesn't necessarily mean its problems are over. There's still the matter of finding enough relationship stories to fill up issue after issue after issue. Whereas the editors of, say, Newsweek need merely look back at a week and rehash the news, most magazine editors haven't the luxury afforded by random events. Whether the niche is golfing, hunting, cat fancy, or fitness, as we first reported a couple of years ago, specialty publications have to generate stories relying solely on their own editorial imaginations.
I was thinking, obviously, our average reader doesn't have a trainer all the time.
Right.
But if we could do some kind of comparison where we have three women or four women start a six-week regimen.
We're trying to do it. It's sort of...
This is the story meeting at Fitness, the women's magazine of body, mind, and spirit. And things are a little tense. Every story suggested seems so been done already.
There's something there, but I don't think
we
nailed it.
What if you throw diet into the mix and say, you know, maybe they all want to lose
like
20
tactics,
pounds or something,
right,
and one
totally
person tries
tactics.
Diet alone, one person tries exercise alone, and then another person has both.
But we tell people all the time that you need both.
One by one, the staffers pitch ideas, and one by one, gently, editor-in-chief Emily Listfield shoots them down. But in time, the magazine will be filled because, Listfield explains, it's just a question of tuning into the readers.
It's just listening to women talk. And when you listen to women talk, you get a million ideas. There's something new every day that they're curious about.
The problem is that curiosity is limited to very few spheres of human existence. For instance, in the June issue, the cover boasted a 30-minute thigh sculpting workout, whereas in May, it was a better butt in 10 minutes, and in July, it was the breakthrough workout to burn fat all day long. Fitness, of course, is for women. A men's health magazine has concerns far different from feminine body obsession. Steve Perrine is the editorial creative director of Men's Health.
Women tend to be self-conscious about their thighs and their butts, and men tend to be self-conscious about their stomachs.
So hence, in July, the fastest ab plan ever. In June, you had a story, 10 greatest ab exercises ever. May, all-star abs. October, find your abs. September, machine-built abs. A lot of ab stories.
Well, some of the stories are part of plans that we put together, which guys can follow month to month. Others are very particular, interesting takes. For example, the All-Star Abs, what we did is we picked a bunch of athletes and celebrities who are in particularly great shape, and we had them give us their workouts.
Celebrity abs. Nice touch. Both editors insist their magazines offer fresh takes on the kinds of issues most important to their readers. In fact, according to John Fine, my advertising age colleague on the magazine beat, readers may want nothing more from their glossies than a game effort to wrap familiar material in new packages, because whether the category is beauty or fitness or golf, these magazines tend to be feeding fantasies in the first place.
There's always the hope that in 6 months, you know, you're going to, you know, golf a 72. I mean, there's always the hope that in 6 months, you know, you're going to drop 20 pounds and, you know, put on 15 pounds of lean body weight. But I mean, if you're looking at it really obsessively, there's an infinite amount of variation. There's an infinite amount of ways you can talk about it. It becomes, I don't know, like a song that you listen to over and over again.
Or maybe, in its endless superficial variation on theme, like pornography. Or maybe another vice altogether.
To me, instruction editorial is the heroine of golf magazines. It may make you feel good for a moment, but it really kills creativity in the publication, I think.
John Atwood is editor-in-chief of Travel and Leisure Golf, a magazine that prides itself on transcending the five tips for mastering the sand wedge sort of material that fills its competition month after month. We visited his editorial meeting, too, and found a magazine with content bounded only by the limitations of its travel budget.
Oh, Ireland. On one of our trips last year, we used the services of a helicopter company, and that seems to be becoming the preferred mode of transportation around Ireland. So, you know, given who our audience is, I think we need to do something on that topic.
The Irish helicopter tour was such a fetching subject, in fact, that Travel and Leisure Golf had done it already in the current issue. No problem for coming issues, though. There are many other countries and several other modes of transportation. Editors such as Atwood have one sort of challenge, interesting essentially the same audience month after month. Diane Forden of Bridal Guide magazine has the opposite problem, interesting an ever-changing pool of readers without boring herself right out of her skull. Her readership turns over every 6 to 14 months.
So that's the creative challenge, especially when you work for a bridal magazine, is how do we keep this material fresh? How do we keep it relevant? How do we, you know, get the reader excited, keep ourselves excited?
But every month she has to do a wedding gown story, and every month she has to do a wedding planning story, and every month she has to do a cake story.
We don't want to photograph the same type of cake story. I think once we did a cake for all seasons, so it was different wedding cakes for your seasons. We didn't want to repeat that, but we still wanted to present an idea of showing wonderful wedding cakes, but what was our theme? What was our idea? We know we repeat ourselves, yes, but we always give it a new twist, a new angle.
It's all about angles. The editorial process at these magazines is about 10% journalism and 90% geometry.
Everybody's always doing look great naked. I really like the idea of feel great naked. 50 reasons to love your body.
50 reasons to love your body. Splendid idea. Next month, 51 reasons to love your body. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Ann Kosseff, and edited this week only by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org. For the first time ever, this show is also being podcasted. You can get instructions at onthemedia.org. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.